a protein targeted by tecovirimat, an antiviral drug being tested for use against monkeypox in humans.
Part 2.
If anyone sees the blood on the wall and torn clothes, he would understand that a catastrophic event took place here.
Tonight, they became the gates to hell. Suicide bombings have claimed numerous lives.
ISIS has claimed responsibility for the attack there in Afghanistan.
August 26th, 2021, Kabul Airport. One of the deadliest terrorist attacks in Afghanistan. ...169 Afghans lost their lives in a terrorist attack at two gates, Karzai International Airport. This attack exactly coincided with the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. This deadly attack is just one example of the massacres that terrorists committed in Afghanistan. This bloodbath will never end. America's Response Monument in New York City, a statue of an American soldier on horseback. Many people think that this statue is related to the American Civil Wars in the 19th century or to World War II, but surprisingly, it is related to the 21st century and the presence of American troops in Afghanistan.
And there's a picture of them on horseback.
But why U.S. Special Forces rode horses in Afghanistan? These soldiers were actually security forces from the CIA and the Pentagon, who, in the early days of the occupation of Afghanistan, were responsible for providing intelligence support to the Afghan proxy forces, along with carrying out airstrikes. He gradually started small uprisings against the occupying forces. In 2006, the Taliban could retake control of significant parts of Afghanistan thanks to irregular warfare campaigns, a process that continued year after year. They thought about negotiations with some of Mullah Muhammad Omar's deputies after the failure of conventional wars against the Taliban and the increase in the West's military expenses. The New York Times, in an article published on June 19, 2017, explained in detail who exactly supported Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi. This article suggested the Afghan intelligence agency paid each member of this group salaries equivalent to $150 to $300 a month to fight against the Taliban and Afghanistan's neighbors. It was interesting that the Afghan government kept supporting him until his last breath. Mullah Manan Niazi was transferred to Kabul Hospital. Finally, He lost his life due to the severity of his injuries. A huge burial ceremony was conducted by the support of the government in Herat. Sayyid Vahid Ghatali, then Herat governor, participated in his funeral. They buried him in a place that required the permission of the government. The government supported terrorists like Abdulmanan Niazi, who believed the only way to achieve political and economic goals was to kill Afghans. And the only reason the government supported such a person was that it could use him against the Taliban to prevent the fall of Herat. They wanted to reach their goal by killing hundreds of innocent Afghans. After Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi's death, Khalid Niazi succeeded his father. At first, he said that he would continue exactly the same way as his late father. But Khalid Niazi changed his mind after a short time and handed over all the weapons of his faction to the Islamic Emirate and pledged allegiance to Habibullah Akhundzada. Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi was not the only enemy of Akhundzada, and Daesh Takfiri terrorist group was definitely a new challenge for the Taliban. What does Daesh Takfiri terrorist group mean in Afghanistan? Terrorists in Iraq and Syria weren't the same Takfiri terrorists.
The Islamic State affiliate, ISIS-K.
Islamic State Khorasan, or ISIS-K.
The group known as ISIS-K.
What does the K stand for in ISIS-K?
So ISIS-K, or the K in ISIS-K, stands for Khorasan, which is sort of the medieval term used for, you know, Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, the broader region.
This group became known as Daesh Khorasan. The K stands for Khorasan, which refers to parts of Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan in medieval ages.
Terrorist group known as ISIS-K, an ISIS affiliate in Afghanistan, which is a sworn enemy of the Taliban as well.
Daesh-K wanted to create their own caliphate in Afghanistan, just like Daesh Takfiri terrorists in Iraq and Syria. This terrorist group was predominantly based in Afghan province of Nangarhar.
ISIS-K is predominantly based in the Afghan province of Nangarhar, which borders Pakistan. And they have been trying to create their own caliphate there. So their goal is, like ISIS, is to create a caliphate.
Part of Daesh's financial resources were mainly obtained from criminal activities such as drug trafficking.
They are also heavily involved in criminal activities such as narcotics and human trafficking. They control some front companies as well, such as car dealerships.
False charity organizations were in charge of financing the Daesh terrorist group. The Nejat Afghan Charity Foundation, this foundation collected donations from Saudi Arabia, Turkey, the UAE, and Bahrain. Syed Habib Ahmad Khan was the head of the Nejat Afghan Charity Foundation since 2019. He lives in Kuwait right now. Ruhollah Wakili was one of the executive directors of this foundation. They were important figures in financing the Daesh terrorists. The Nejat Social Welfare Organization transferred the collected money through Hawala to the banks of the former government of Afghanistan. Americans were responsible for financial management of these banks.
Jihadists are aware of the quote-unquote cracks in the Western financial system. Informal remittances are not just a crack, they're a Grand Canyon. There have been many incidents relating to terror finance, both in the United States and overseas. Some examples include the use of Hawala in areas our adversaries operate, such as Afghanistan.
After 2015, some articles associated the keyword Daesh Khorasan with the Taliban. These articles try to imply that these two groups were competing to gain power in Afghanistan, while the intellectual basis and political goals of the Taliban were completely different from Daesh terrorists. Taliban subscribe to the Hanafi school, and most Afghans follow it. Despite the fact the Takfiri Salafi jurisprudence of Daesh has no historical roots in Afghanistan, Daesh terrorists call anyone that has beliefs contrary to theirs as infidels, like Shia Muslims, the Taliban, and Al-Qaeda terrorist groups.
The important difference that they believe anybody is not member of our group, he is not Muslim. So they believe that Al-Qaeda also, when not accepting us as the leadership, the leader, they are not Muslims. So like they are infidels, and Shias are infidels, and Taliban are infidels.
Daesh recognizes the Taliban members as infidels because of their ideology about Shia and Sunni Muslims. In terms of political goals, the Taliban defines the government in favor of Afghanistan's national interests, but on the other hand, Daesh considers itself a transnational movement, and Afghanistan is only part of the so-called Islamic Caliphate.
The Taliban wants to get the United States out of Afghanistan, and they want to set up a new state. They want to rule Afghanistan. ISIS has not shown an interest in building a traditional state. They want to build a larger regional Muslim empire, in a sense. So I think you see two very different goals there. You can think of the Taliban as a replacement to the Afghan state. You can think of ISIS as seeking to bring the Afghan state into a regional revolution, which might not involve a state in Afghanistan.
That would be a caliphate, right?
Correct. That would be a caliphate, and it would involve crossing borders. It's the difference between wanting to create a modern set of institutions or wanting to go back to some set of institutions that are not defined by what we would recognize today as functioning bureaucracies and functioning institutions. The Taliban wants institutions. They just want them to be their institutions. We might find them offensive, but they still are institutions they want to use to rule that state. ISIS wants to control the region, doesn't care as much what kind of state Afghanistan has.
The point of view of Daesh was proven when Hafiz Saeed Khan, founder of Daesh K, pledged allegiance to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi in 2015. It is very interesting that Daesh K emerged in 2015 as an entity along with the rebellions of Mullah Mansur Dadullah and Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi.
ISK emerged in 2015 as an entity.
In 2015, Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi announced that Daesh did not exist in Afghanistan and they were insignificant. According to the New York Times report, Mansur Dadullah's group secretly allied with Daesh K in 2015. They pursued the same objectives against the Taliban, but Taliban leader Mullah Akhtar Mansur suppressed the rebellion. Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi and Mansur Dadullah's political parties were both in Afghanistan, but Daesh did not have any historical and political roots in Afghanistan. The question is here: how could they organize a large network inside the country in a short period of time? The answer lies outside the borders of Afghanistan. Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, the IMU, that was founded by Tohirjo Idosh in Uzbekistan. This group had been carrying out terrorist attacks in northern Afghanistan since the late 1990s, but they entered Afghanistan again in 2014 and 2015. Osman Ghazi, leader of the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, pledged allegiance to Daesh K. Later, he officially declared the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan a branch of Daesh Takfiri terrorists in 2015.
Militant Uzbek, what they called IMU, Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, and ideological differences came and they, some of them split to join Daesh.
Other groups in Central Asian countries continue joining Daesh Khorasan, a huge number of extremist forces who were trained in Wahhabi schools entered Afghanistan. On the other hand, many terrorists from the Central Asian countries who could not go to Syria and Iraq because of the border barriers entered Afghanistan as well. But the most important thing was a transfer of a huge amount of troops and weapons from Syria and Iraq to Afghanistan. It was definitely not possible for many Daesh forces to enter Afghanistan along with their weapons overland, and they had to carry them on helicopters. But the point here is that during the former government of Afghanistan, the Americans controlled the Afghan skies. According to the Economic Times, the U.S. bases were safe places for Daesh terrorists to enter Afghanistan from Syria and Iraq in silence.
We have seen some reports and videos coming out that Uzbek fighters had transferred from Syria to fight in Afghanistan. And we have seen some evidence that some Tajiks have been diverted. They couldn't go to Syria and Iraq because the border with Turkey was closed, and they were diverted via Iran across the border into Afghanistan.
Most Uyghur terrorists came to Afghanistan from Xinjiang, China. Some members of the Chinese Turkestan Islamic Movement joined Daesh Khorasan in Afghanistan.
Since 9/11, all the linkages between Uyghur separatism and or terrorism with various forms of radical Islamism in Central Asia, Afghanistan.
Jaish ul Adl terrorist group was a branch of Iran's disbanded Jandullah terrorist group. According to reports, some members of this terrorist group who were based in Pakistan joined Daesh K in Afghanistan. But the question is that, how did countless terrorists enter Afghanistan despite U.S. full support of the government's National Directorate of Security? National Directorate of Security of Afghanistan consisted of National Army, Ministry of Interior Affairs, and National Directorate of Security. At the head of this security structure was the National Security Advisor. After the emergence of Daesh Takfiri terrorist group in Afghanistan, Hanif Atmar became the National Security Advisor of the government between 2015 to 2018. Hamdullah Mohib served as National Security Advisor under former Afghan President Ashraf Ghani from 2018 to the end of his 20-year rule. Afghanistan's security system, in close relations with the CIA, MI6, and the Pentagon, had achieved extensive financial and information access. All things considered, it sounds impossible that the Afghan National Directorate of Security was unaware of the entrance of Daesh terrorists into Afghanistan. Because the transfer of the terrorists and weapons was impossible without coordination with authorities in power. The entrance of foreign terrorists into Afghanistan was accompanied by the revelations of the former deputy of the Afghan parliament, Abdulzahir Qadir. Abdulzahir Qadir was one of Fazal Hadi Muslim Yar's old friends. Fazal Hadi Muslim Yar was the head of Afghanistan's Senate. Abdulzahir Qadir referred to the transfer of Daesh terrorists from the south of Afghanistan to the north of the country, quoting the words of the former head of the Senate. In this regard, there were many reports of the resignation of the officials of some provinces. The governors of provinces like Paktia and Khost, and the most important resignation was that of Salim Khan Qunduzi, the governor of Nangarhar province, to which the ARG's authorities had no response. But Abdulzahir Qatir knew the reason for the silence. The cooperation of Afghan security organizations with Daesh terrorists was the answer to the puzzle. Abdulzahir Qatir criticized Hanif Atmar and Abdullah Mohib as the national security advisors. Abdulzahir Qatir did not consider the position of advisor as an executive position. While in Afghanistan, the national security advisor was in charge of the entire government. Abdulzahir Qadir's declarations came with many reactions in the political circles and the media in Afghanistan. People in society thought that the Afghani government was turned into a safe haven for the Daesh commanders. The conflict in Jalzjan in 2018 was the best example of the Afghan government's cooperation with the Daesh terrorists. In this war, the Taliban defeated the Daesh terrorists. After Taliban's victory, the existence of this terrorist group started to decline in Afghanistan. But interesting incidents happened after Daesh's deterioration.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
The United States is not what is shown in flamboyant Hollywood movies. You can't get the real image of this country when a disaster happens. Destroyed houses, lack of food and medicines, erected tents on sidewalks are just a few examples of normal life in a hurricane-hit U.S. This time, Florida is bearing the brunt of this burden, with the death toll mounting in the aftermath of Hurricane Ian, which made land landfall on the state's coast as a Category 4 storm last Wednesday, September 28, bringing devastating storm surges to the Cape Coral-Fort Myers area and deadly flooding across the state. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. The Socialist website wrote, at least 103 people have been confirmed dead in Florida and 5 in North Carolina, though the total is expected to be higher, as search and rescue teams are still working through the wreckage. Lee County, which includes Cape Coral and Fort Myers, alone accounts for 54 of the deaths. Sheriff Carmine Marceno said recently, up from the county's previous death toll of 42. Neighboring Charlotte County, where the hurricane made landfall, has the second most recorded deaths at 24. As of now, most of the deaths were drownings, according to officials. Statewide, more than 2,300 rescues have been made, and over 1,000 urban search and rescue personnel have checked 79,000 structures, according to Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in a press conference. The death toll in Lee County is likely in no small part due to the failure to issue timely evacuation orders, with residents being given a mandatory evacuation order on September 27th, less than 24 hours before Ian made landfall, despite warnings that they were in the storm's path made since at least September 23rd. Over 700 people have been rescued in the county so far, according to Marceno. Governor DeSantis defended the delayed evacuation order, telling reporters that county officials were following the data which showed the storm making landfall in Tampa Bay, which is in Hillsborough County, before shifting south to Lee County. The implication of this is that the government decided that the effect on businesses through the evacuation of two counties outweighed the loss of lives if the storm were to change course. DeSantis, who is in the running to replace fascistic ex-President Donald Trump as leader of the Republican Party, no doubt is attempting to burnish his credentials as a ruthless defender of the profits of the financial elite. It is much in keeping with the policy of herd immunity pursued by his administration in Florida, which has killed over 80,000 people in the state. The governor has only just now announced the opening of the first disaster recovery center, with DeSantis announcing that other disaster recovery centers are being opened by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, and the Florida Division of Emergency Management. Florida has seen rental prices increase by more than 30% over the past 2 years. The loss in housing stock through the destruction of houses means that prices for homes are expected to increase even further. As a result of the lack of alternatives, many are resorting to staying in waterlogged rooms of their homes or becoming homeless. Robert McLean, 67, a military veteran and retired construction worker, was interviewed by New York Times in the garage of his waterlogged rental home. He said that he had few options but to live in his car. He said, "I'm not running to go to live in the Hilton. You know what I'm saying." He concluded, "I'm totally screwed." The The website of News Press also wrote, the lingering impacts of deadly Hurricane Ian have led southwest Florida reeling, but a new menace has emerged recently as disease-carrying mosquitoes are blanketing the region. With a storm surge of more than 15 feet in some areas and more than 1 foot of rain in others, the landscape is soggy and saturated, perfect conditions for spreading West Nile and dengue fever. Eric Jackson, spokesman for the Lee County Mosquito Control District, said, "They are really everywhere, all over. We have pilots in the air and we are going to get every single spot." Cooler, drier weather was welcome in the wake of Ian, especially for a community buried in trees and construction debris. But disease-carrying species emerged about a week after Ian made landfall, adding another layer of public safety concern to a region stricken with the health challenges. Jackson said recently, "We have really stepped up the adulty side, and tonight we will have planes out to get the county cover up to help the people, and then we will focus on larvae side."
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
As the crisis in Ukraine is getting worse, chances for a diplomatic solution to the war are looking slim. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has signed a decree that formally declares the prospect of any Ukrainian talks with Kremlin leader Vladimir Putin, quote, impossible. The decree also approves the decision of Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council to strengthen Ukrainian defense. The decree came after Russia annexed four regions of Ukraine into its own territory. President Putin has just signed into law four unification treaties with the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics, as well as the Kherson and Zaporozhye region. Russia says Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics split from Ukraine in 2014 following what Kremlin describes as the Maidan coup. Russia's decision to incorporate the regions into its own territory comes amid reports of Ukraine's military advances. According to President Zelensky, Ukrainian forces have retaken dozens of villages from Russia in the east and the south of the country. However, the latest maps revealed by Moscow showed Russian troops had already left many areas in Kherson and northeastern Kharkiv region.
Тільки за цю добу на Херсонщині від псевдореферендуму було звільнено і стабілізовано такі населені пункти, як Нововоскресенське, Новогригорівка і Петропавлівка. Рух продовжує.
Ukraine is now trying to make further inroads in the south and east before the colder weather arrives. Russia is trying to deploy the 300,000 reservists called up in a partial mobilization 2 weeks ago. But that would take some time before it can be operational. The developments come as the U.S. is sending more weapons into Ukraine.
This morning, President Biden spoke with President Zelensky to underscore that the United States will never recognize Russia's purported annexation of Ukrainian territory and will continue to support Ukraine as it defends itself from Russian aggression. President Biden informed President Zelensky that the United States is providing a new $625 million security assistance package to Ukraine as they continue to defend their country from Russia's invasion.
The new $625 million military package approved by the Biden administration includes additional weapons and equipment, including HIMARS, artillery systems and ammunition, and armored vehicles. The United States has now sent Ukraine more than $16.8 billion in military hardware. Russia has now warned that the shipment of new military hardware to Ukraine will risk direct confrontation with the United States. The supply of military products by the U.S. and its allies not only entails protracted bloodshed and new casualties, but also increases the danger of a direct military clash between Russia and Western countries. Concerns are now rising over a possible nuclear confrontation between nuclear-armed states. Russia's President Vladimir Putin has already warned that his threat to use nuclear weapons is not a bluff. The war in Ukraine has already caused a crisis for the European Union. Energy prices have soared and the rising cost of living is putting many Europeans into poverty.
We have now to limit this inflationary impact of gas on electricity and everywhere in Europe. This is why we are ready to discuss a cap on the price of gas that is used to generate electricity. This cap would also be a first step on the way to a structural reform, an overall reform of our electricity market.
There are now signs that the support for Ukraine amongst Europeans is dropping. A survey by Opinions pollster has revealed that 60% of EU's population were on board with sending weapons to Kiev. The number was 64% back in March. It now appears that the lingering crisis in Ukraine could lead to social unrest across the continent. European leaders are concerned over the rise of far-right groups, which could potentially create cracks within the anti-Moscow coalition in Brussels.
Back in April, a temporary UN-mediated ceasefire was reached between Yemen's Ansarullah movement and the Saudi-led coalition. It was renewed twice, leading to a respite from a bloody war that has ravaged the country for years, killing 150,000 people. The Saudi kingdom and its allies, most notably the United Arab Emirates, have been waging a war against Yemen since March 2015, trying in vain to reinstall the exiled Saudi-friendly regime of Abd Rabu Mansour Hadi. The military campaign, which has been enjoying arms, logistic, intelligence, and political support from the United States and some other Western countries, has killed hundreds of thousands of people and turned Yemen into the scene of the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Now, the truce is ended, with sides failing to reach a consensus about the renewal of the ceasefire. In a statement, the Ansarullah movement has blamed the impasse on the Saudi-led coalition's failure to live up to its commitments and its reluctance to address humanitarian issues as a top priority. It also slammed Saudi Arabia and its allies for their refusal to talk about measures that would alleviate the suffering of the Yemeni people. Yemeni Foreign Minister Hisham Sharaf Abdullah also said the other side's failure to respond to the purely humanitarian demands presented by Sana'a has confirmed, beyond any doubt, its lack of seriousness in moving towards reaching a comprehensive and sustainable peaceful political settlement. Meanwhile, Yemen's armed forces have put oil companies operating in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates on notice, warning that they could be targeted as long as Riyadh and its allies fail to commit to a proper ceasefire. Sana'a says the coalition has repeatedly violated the humanitarian and military armistice. On April 10th, only a week after the agreement came into force, the Saudi coalition committed over 1,600 violations, including offensive operations, airstrikes, overflights by warplanes, spy planes, and Apache helicopters, as well as missile and artillery targets, resulting in the death of a number of people. And until the end of the ceasefire on October the 2nd, the number of violations of the coalition forces has reached over 34,500. So, apparently from the very beginning, Riyadh and its allies were not serious and honest about efforts to end the war. UN has expressed its disappointment with the failure to extend Yemen's truce, saying negotiations are underway for a potential extension to the ceasefire, urging calm on the warring sides. But what will happen if the fighting resumes? The ceasefire has brought a sharp drop in fighting in the war, but now millions will once again be at risk of air strikes, ground shelling, and missile attacks. Also, with the ceasefire in place, the daily lives of the Yemeni people dramatically improved. Fuel imports into the port of Hodeidah have quadrupled, while more essential goods entered the blockaded country and prices came down. In addition, the international charity Save the Children said the truce had led to a 60% decrease in displacement and a 34% drop in child casualties in Yemen. The Saudi-led military campaign had caused the internal displacement of 4.3 million Yemenis by March 2022. Humanitarian organizations have called on both sides to extend the arm of diplomacy, pointing out that 8 to 23 million people out of a total population of 30 million will be severely affected. So, if the humanitarian and military armistice is not renewed, everything will go back to square one. The risk of a large-scale famine, violence, collapsing services, and protracted displacement are the biggest challenges in Yemen now. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has severely censured the unrest that erupted in some parts of Iran following the death of a young woman, stating that the deadly riots were orchestrated in advance by the United States and the Israeli regime. Ayatollah Khamenei made the comment in an address to military cadets in Tehran, saying he was saddened by the death of a young woman, which triggered the riots. Protests over the death of Mahsa Amini, a 22-year-old Iranian woman who fainted at a police station and was later pronounced dead at a hospital, erupted first in her native province of Kurdistan and later spread to other parts of the country, including Tehran. The leader said reactions to the incident were not normal. The riots were not natural, as groups of people caused social disturbances on the streets, burned copies of the Holy Quran, harassed veiled women, and set mosques, religious congregational halls, and private cars on fire. According to a statement released by the Iranian Intelligence Ministry, the rioters have been backed by Western regimes and their mercenary media, who disseminated misinformation and distorted the sequence of events that led to Amini's death, even before the official investigation into the incident concludes. Also, the intelligence ministry said 9 people from Germany, Poland, Italy, France, the Netherlands, Sweden, and other countries have been arrested for their role in the riots. From the very beginning, different Western media began a campaign against Iran voicing support for the rioters. That's why they have remained silent for years about the strict sanctions imposed on Iran. Meanwhile, a teenage girl named Zainab Esam Majid al-Khazali was killed during American military drills near a U.S. military camp close to the international airport in the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. There was an effective blackout on the death in Western media. So why are they refusing to show the same sensibility about Zainab's death? Seemingly, what matters most is creating turmoil in the stable nations in West Asia. Shortly after the death of Mahsa Amini, allegations of mistreatment and even torture surfaced in social media platforms, and Western media outlets lost no time in picking up the story and willfully distorting it. Before any official statement was made, Iran was accused of deliberate killing, and Mahsa was brutally killed by Iranian police was the talk of the town. Unsurprisingly, these headlines come as part of a systematic campaign to attack Iran and cause turmoil in the country.
There have been more anti-government protests in the Iranian capital, Tehran.
Just a moment ago, protests spreading in the country of Iran over the death of a young woman earlier this month.
The protests in Iran.
In addition, for years, the West, particularly the United States, has been trying to stop Iran's progress by using economic sanctions, military threats, cyber attacks, and assassinations. In his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said the U.S. and its allies' main problem is a strong and independent Iran and the country's progress. He pointed to the country's progress in all sectors, efforts aimed at facilitating domestic production, activation of knowledge-based companies, and the country's ability to neutralize Western sanctions. The leader said that enemies are gravely mistaken in their calculations, and their plots will not yield anything at all. And he's right. Iranians once again foiled the enemy's plots after huge crowds of people took to the streets across Iran to denounce acts of vandalism and desecration of Islamic sanctities by rioters, sending a strong message that Iran's security and stability is the most important issue.
When it comes to the relationship between the EU and Israel, one thing is evident. The EU comes out defending Palestinians and condemns Israel for its different violations, from settlements to the killing of Palestinians. But words of condemnations are just that, words. For when it comes to doing anything about it, it does absolutely nothing. There is a broad consensus that the EU is not an honest broker when it comes to Israel and Palestine, and that the very DNA of the Israel-EU relationship reveals that on Palestinian rights, Brussels only condemns Israeli illegal acts. Be it in response to the unfounded allegations in the 2021 dossier, which offered no proof to justify the terror label for Palestinian groups, or to the all-frequent military onslaught on Gaza. The EU has done little to hold Israel accountable besides ritual but ineffectual expressions of concern. In fact, the EU recently reiterated its commitment to developing closer diplomatic ties and agreed to resume meetings of the EU-Israel Association Council. Another sign of Europe's somewhat covert support for Israel is a memorandum of understanding between the EU, Egypt, and Israel, where Cairo is set to export Israeli gas to Europe. All this has also shed light on the West's double standards regarding the Palestine-Israel conflict, and this has only been further clarified through the West's support of Ukraine in light of the Russian special military operation there. The world rallied behind Ukraine and left Palestinians frustrated, who witnessed being criminalized and were constantly being told that they don't have the right to resist, or even labeled as terrorists or anti-Semites just for asking for their rights. Despite the long list of horrific human rights violations in Palestine and other atrocities in the world, the West is yet to display a unified response to the Israeli aggressions. But what makes matters worse is the West claims it supports human rights, like for Palestinians, yet continues to do nothing when it comes to the Israeli violations of Palestinian rights. In 2021, Manu Pineda, the chair of the European Parliament delegation for relations with Palestine, stated that Israel has inflicted brutal violence against Palestinians in Al-Quds who were resisting their forced displacement, so settlers can take their place, adding that this is part of Israel's ongoing attempts to erase the Palestinian presence from the city. But what he said further shows how the EU is actually funding the Israeli violations against Palestinians. He said the EU cannot continue to have an association agreement with Israel and called on the bloc to move to terminate it. This showed that the EU money was being used to fund entities and illegal settlements and to subsidize Israel's arms industry. Yet, in action, none of those promises were kept. Palestinians have been, in essence, ripped off of their rights and been subject to ethnic cleansing occupation, and oppression for over seven decades now, and the double standard and hypocrisy shown by the West, especially the EU, only demonstrates that fighting military aggression as well as fighting for rights and how its approach towards or labeled is solely dependent on the identity of the aggressor with no regard to the tragic consequences. So in short, the EU may condemn Israeli acts of violation, but it truly supports Israel. Gaza is under a blockade by Israel, which claims it is the only way to confront the Palestinian resistance who hold power in the area. EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell explained that there is no solution to the West Asia conflict without a very strong commitment on part of the US. Many attempts were made in the past, but at the moment there appears to be no path forward. Such reactions, however, aren't new to Palestinians, as they have on multiple occasions seen the EU and even the UN condemning Israeli actions, including warnings over the mass displacement of Palestinians, but no actions to prevent it. The EU says it supports Palestinians, but continues to further strengthen its ties both politically and economically with Israel. And this only proves that it is not an honest or effective stakeholder in the struggle for Palestinian sovereignty and independence. Its actions have so far only allowed Israel to continue its acts of aggression with complete impunity.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Russian President Vladimir Putin has recently said Western countries are hurting everyone, including their own people. And he was right. Believe it or not, the world is going to be multipolar as world economies are exhausted by the U.S. military and financial bullying. And when we talk about the U.S. decline, we cannot avoid talking about de-dollarization and end of the dollar hegemony in the world. So efforts are underway to topple this hegemony. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Global Times, in its recent opinion, wrote this headline saying, China and Russia to strengthen cooperation on the way to a multipolar world. Global Times wrote, China will strengthen cooperation with Russia and work together with other members of the international community to boost the multipolarization of the world. Chinese experts said, as the 7th Eastern Economic Forum, EEF, was held in Vladivostok, Russia. Russia also harshly criticized Western sanctions against it over Ukraine crisis, as they have brought great damage to everyone around the world, including their own people in the West. Russian President Vladimir Putin said recently at the forum that the West is failing. The future is in Asia. Western nations are hurting everyone, including their own people, in an attempt to preserve global dominance that is slipping from their hands, Putin noted. He also said the efforts to isolate Russia were in vain amid a pivot toward Asia, media reported. The unfolding global economic crisis was triggered by Western elites who would not or even cannot acknowledge objective facts about global changes, the Russian president said. Leaders in the US and their allies are seeking to preserve the world order that benefits only them, forcing everyone to live under the rules which they invented and which they regularly break and constantly change depending on the situation, Putin remarked. Facing opposition from nations that don't want to bend to their will, the U.S. and its allies lash out and take short-sighted decisions that hurt not only the dissenters, but also their own nations, Putin stated, referring to a growing detachment of Western elites from the common people. Li Jianshu, chairman of the National People's Congress Standing Committee, attended the plenary session of the EEF recently. Wang Yivi, director of the Institute of International Affairs at the Renmin University of China, told the Global Times recently that under the huge impacts brought about by the sanctions and the major power competition strategy launched by the US and its Western allies, the necessity and importance of the China-Russia cooperation is rising, and the two countries will have to work together to safeguard and reform the international order while the U.S. is trying to break and reshape one to serve its hegemony. A Beijing-based expert on international relations who asked for anonymity said the U.S. is unhappy with the current international order and globalization, as Washington's elites believe that the current order benefits only the rising powers, especially China, while weakening U.S. hegemony, so it's using regional problems like Ukraine crisis and Taiwan Straits tension to mobilize its allies to serve U.S. strategy of containing China and Russia, but it has underestimated the resilience and strength of its competitors. More importantly, it has ignored the damage to the people around the globe, such as the terrible energy and food crisis. So this makes more and more countries realize the danger, uncertainty, and risk of a U.S.-dominated order or a polarized world. And that's why the EEF's theme this year is on the way to a multipolar world. This has reflected a consensus shared by more and more countries worldwide, the anonymous expert noted. The website of China Briefing also wrote, it's gone under the radar, but China's trade and investment in the Russian Far East is significant and growing fast. Several discussions between Chinese and Russian officials at a senior level, including with China's chairman of the Standing Committee of the National People's Congress, Li Jiangxu, Russian President Vladimir Putin and others, took place at the Eastern Economic Forum recently. These outlined the future direction of China-Russia relations, new investments and cooperation, and serve as a preamble towards a meeting between Presidents Putin and Xi, expected to be conducted in Samarkand, the capital of Uzbekistan, at the hands of a state meeting of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization next week from September 15th to 16th. It will be the first meeting between the two since Beijing Winter Olympics, although they are known to have frequent, detailed conversations on a regular basis.